It's Super Tuesday Eve. Good morning. We're live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, early voting kicks off today in Northeast Florida. We'll tell you how the candidates for president are reaching out to all of you, the Florida voters, right now. Who will get your vote? Give us a call. It's 549-2937. Then later, Operation New Hope expands to St. John's County. That's ahead. But first this morning, a slew of states go to the polls tomorrow for Super Tuesday. But early voting is beginning in some parts of Florida today. That includes Duval County. So we're beginning the hour with a closer look at the lay of the land in the Democratic primary race for president. You may have seen that over the weekend, Tom Steyer and Pete Buttigieg dropped out of the race. That leaves Democratic primary voters in Florida with six candidates to choose from: Joe Biden, Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, Mike Bloomberg, Amy Klobuchar, and Tulsi Gabbard. We're speaking to a prominent surrogate for the Warren campaign this morning. He's Frederick Joseph, a writer and marketer who's famed for creating the largest GoFundMe campaign in history, the Black Panther Challenge. That challenge raised nearly $1 million to allow tens of thousands of kids around the world to see Black Panther in theaters. Joseph is also on the Forbes 30 Under 30 list, and he is a surrogate for the Elizabeth Warren campaign. Frederick Joseph, such a pleasure. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being with us. Who will get your vote for president? Give us a call right now. It's 549-2937 to join us. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaNJax. And our Facebook page is open. All right. After the South Carolina primary, which Joe Biden won decisively, there have been calls for candidates in the race like your chosen candidate, Elizabeth Warren, to drop out ahead of Super Tuesday. What's your response to that?
Well, I think, first of all, this campaign was built for the long haul, right? It's the same messaging we've had since the beginning, and we're excited going into Super Tuesday. We're nowhere near dropping out, and we firmly know that we will be getting to the convention.
And why should Elizabeth Warren go all the way to the convention? Given that she hasn't won a single state, she's far behind in the delegate count, why should she keep going?
Well, she should keep going because of the fact that we have a plan, right? Which is a bit cliche now based on the fact that she has a plan for everything. But realistically, we feel good going into Super Tuesday and the rest of the early states. So there's no reason to be looking at dropping out. We're very focused on tomorrow and, you know, we're taking it one step at a time.
Why should Democratic primary voters choose Senator Warren if their primary objective is to deny Donald Trump a second term, and they perceive that perhaps Joe Biden or Bernie Sanders is better positioned to beat Trump than Senator Warren? What's your message to them?
Well, I think that out of the three people you just named, the only one who's already dismantled a billionaire is Elizabeth Warren, right? Joe Biden and Bernie Sanders had the chance while on the debate stage against Bloomberg. And really, Bloomberg has taken them both to task, both his campaign via their social media accounts and on the debate stage. The only person who absolutely put a dent in him was Elizabeth. And you know, realistically, when you look at the leaked information that came from 2016, that Bloomberg jumped in the race because he needed to stop progressives, as he said, and specifically stop Elizabeth Warren. So, you know, these people like a Bloomberg, like a Trump, understand that Elizabeth Warren is the actual candidate who can beat them.
If you're just tuning in, we're speaking with Elizabeth Warren surrogate Frederick Joseph, the creator of the Black Panther Challenge. We'll go to your calls in a moment. Let us know your thoughts about the primary race. It's 549-2937. Okay. Is Elizabeth Warren only staying in the race to deny Bernie Sanders more delegates?
Not at all. Not in the slightest. Elizabeth Warren is staying in the race to win.
And what's the strategy to win? The math is not adding up right now for her.
Again, we're looking good going into Super Tuesday. There's a long-term plan to get us all the way to a nomination. You know, as someone who's been on the ground in many states for Super Tuesday, someone who understands what the voters are talking about, so on and so forth, there's a lot of buzz around Elizabeth. And I think that people are going to be pleasantly surprised coming out of coming out of Super Tuesday.
You've been tweeting about Senator Warren's plan for dealing with the coronavirus outbreak this morning. Two confirmed cases are now here in Florida. A commander in chief has to deal with public health emergencies. What would Elizabeth Warren as president be doing differently than what's being done right now to deal with coronavirus?
Well, you know, I think that one of the key things to leadership is foresight, right? So while the White House is currently scrambling to figure out what to do, and other candidates aren't even talking about the impact and issue that is going on with coronavirus, Elizabeth Warren's team rolled out a plan in January. We're now in March, right? Meaning that they were planning for infectious diseases and things of that nature months ago. So I think that this is just a reflection of how meticulous and nuanced she is and her team is in all the things that can impact American lives, right? The second that they started hearing about coronavirus being a major issue globally, they started to plan. They started to think. They started to listen, right? And I think that that's what deeply differentiates her from the other candidates and from Donald Trump. You want someone like that to be leading this country, someone who's not scrambling, someone who's ready.
Fans of Elizabeth Warren and surrogates like yourself have said they believe she has the best plans, the most detailed, thought out plans for dealing with everything from coronavirus to foreign policy issues to the economy and so on. Do you think sexism is playing a role in her inability to break through into the top two delegate getters so far, Joe Biden and Bernie Sanders?
I think that we have a country that needs to grow. Right. Whether that's grow in terms of historic racism or historic sexism, so on and so forth. And we can't deny that these things exist. You know, when Elizabeth Warren is on stage, you know, telling Michael Bloomberg he needs to release women, you know, out of NDAs for things that have happened in his past. And, you know, after the fact, commentators are asking her why she did that. It shows that we have an issue with how we treat women, how we treat people of color, so on and so forth. So the long-winded answer is I think that it plays a part. And if people just vote for the best candidate, she would absolutely be the front runner.
And how are you trying to transmit that message here locally? In South Carolina, Joe Biden overwhelmingly won African-American voters. He's expected to do well in Southern Super Tuesday states with African-American voters. You're the creator of the Black Panther Challenge, which was an amazing GoFundMe effort to get more kids into the theaters to see Black Panther. And so as a high-profile African-American surrogate for Warren, what's your message to African-American voters in our area right now that haven't made up their minds?
I mean, the message has been pretty simple, and it's the same reason why I decided to become a surrogate for her campaign as opposed to someone else. She has the best not only race analysis, she has the best plans for Black people, the best plans for...
What's an example of that?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think that one of the key things for me are her plans around economic justice, right? Understanding that not only in this country, but specifically in Florida and very specifically in Duval, there's an issue of access to wealth, access to entrepreneurship, so on and so forth, especially for Black and brown people. So one of the key things that I noticed is she's not saying, well, across the board, we want to have more entrepreneurs. She's definitely She's definitely doing that, but she's also saying, you know, that's not enough. What we need is $7 billion for Black entrepreneurship, right? In a time where there are predatory loans and things like that and people are going into debt, why not help start creating access for Black entrepreneurs with good plans who don't have historic wealth to tap into? So that $7 billion is just a prime example of what she calls a down payment for some of the historical issues that we've had in communities like Duval, right?
And what would you say to moderate voters in Florida, which tend to swing elections, that Elizabeth Warren is too progressive for them and that her plans would cost too much money?
Well, in my opinion, for the moderates and people who are fiscally conservative and things of that nature, her plans would actually help the economy, right? So you're talking about a boost in the amount of flex spending that people have and things of that nature. So now look at Duval, for example. So last night we were sitting with a group of people who were talking about their student loans and so on and so forth and at barbershops and things of that nature. And people were talking about the $50,000 in student loan debt that she wants to cancel and how much they can put back into the community if that was to happen, right? So her plans, while progressive, are also inherently helping moderates, frankly.
Let's go to some calls now for Frederick Joseph, the creator of the Black Panther Challenge. He is in town. He's a surrogate for Elizabeth Warren's campaign. Super Tuesday is tomorrow in many states around the country. Early voting gets underway in Florida in the primary election in some areas today. That includes Duval County. So who will get your vote? What are your thoughts about the race? 549-2937 to join us. CJ is in Palatka. Hey, CJ, good morning. How are you?
Good morning. Good morning. I just want to make a comment, which does not have to have anything to do with Elizabeth Warren. It is Bernie Sanders, because a lot of people label Bernie Sanders as the democratic socialist just because he is advocating this Medicare for all. But actually, if you think Great Britain is the democracy, Canada is a democracy. Both countries give universal care for all the people. Are they socialist? No, they are not. So Bernie Sanders should be in his speech telling everybody that if they are, he is. If they are not, he is not. He just wants to give everybody health care.
Okay, so it sounds like you're a Sanders supporter, CJ, are you?
I support all Democrats, but just don't want people to label people.
Okay, yeah.
Okay, progressive, liberal, centric, and all that. It's one party.
Sure. Thank you, CJ. Can you take a moment, Frederick, to explain how Elizabeth Warren's approach to health care differs from Bernie Sanders and where they are on the same page, too?
Yeah, so I think that they're on the same page in that they believe that healthcare should be a universal right. And they're also on the same page in that their healthcare plans wouldn't raise the taxes of the middle class, which I think is very important because that's a key point that I think a lot of people don't understand. So where they differentiate is that Elizabeth Warren understands that there needs to be nuance to a rollout, right? So her plan is three steps. One, she wants to make sure that people with pre-existing conditions are covered and helped and roll back a lot of the things that the Trump administration did. Her second point of her plan is to say within the first 100 days, she wants to give people the option of enrolling, which I think is something very different from Bernie Sanders in that gives her time to learn, right? And that's, to me, the personality of the campaign is that they're constantly learning, growing, and pivoting as needed. So not saying that there has to be a wand waved and everyone is forced to do this, and saying, okay, we'll roll this out for some people and people can opt in. And then saying my third point of my plan is to within 3 years have everyone on it. But by that time, we'll have done best practices, learning, so on and so forth. So that's really the only thing that differentiates them, is that she's being more thoughtful about how it's approached.
Why do you think he has more support then?
Well, I think that Bernie, frankly, has been running for 5 years, right? And brand awareness is a real thing. And there are other aspects of this country that are real things. And, so that's what it boils down to.
Let's go to some more calls for Frederick Joseph as we talk about the primary race. 549-2937. Mark is in Mandarin. Hey, Mark, how are you?
Hi.
Good morning.
I just to say that as far as who I'm going to vote for, it doesn't make sense for me to vote before I know what the outcome is going to be on Super Tuesday. Some people are probably going to drop out of the race after Super Tuesday. Half the states will have voted. We'll have a better idea who has a chance of winning in November. Bloomberg has never run in a primary before. We'll see how he does. It just seems to be too soon to make a decision.
Okay. Thanks, man. Thank you, Mark. Yeah, I mean, could some candidates drop out after tomorrow night?
Well, I mean, who knows what's going to happen? We're in a race where no one has the numbers right now, and most of the delegates are up for grabs, frankly, right? So I can't call who's going to drop out. I know that we won't be. You know, everyone is has pretty equal footing right now.
Can you understand why some Democratic primary voters see a hidden strategy to the Warren campaign, saying they will not drop out after Super Tuesday, that perhaps her real imperative is to stop Bernie Sanders from becoming the nominee by pulling down his delegate count as much as she can, staying in the race as long as she can? It's why some people see that Amy Klobuchar is staying in the race until tomorrow night, so as to perhaps deny Bernie Sanders a win in Minnesota, which is Amy Klobuchar's home state, so he wouldn't get those delegates.
No, not at all. We're not playing spoiler.
Go ahead.
Yeah, we're not playing spoiler. We're playing to win. And really, it's sexist even that people would imagine that Elizabeth would be in a race not to win, but to hurt somebody. And I think that it's sexist to say that about both Amy and Elizabeth Warren, right? And I don't think it's a question that's generally being asked of any of the male candidates.
Well, at the same time, Pete Buttigieg dropped out last night, and he was, I think, third in the delegate count. He didn't see a path. So I think that's why calls are growing on the other candidates to drop out.
Well, I think, you know, with Pete Buttigieg, his campaign actually was not in the same place as ours. We actually had $29 million raised in February, right? So people are excited. People are still all in. People are invested. And people are ready to go the distance with us. And I just don't know that Pete's campaign was at that point.
And Pete Buttigieg had a really hard time garnering support from non-white voters. How is the Warren campaign different in the way you reach out to voters of color?
Yeah, I think the Warren campaign is, that's what makes us special, in my opinion. You know, we held a listening session in Charleston, actually, a few weeks ago for just black men to sit with the senator and discuss all of the issues plaguing the community. And it wasn't a matter of it being elected officials. You had people who were farmers, students, local business owners. And she sat, it was closed to the media, and she took out a notepad and she listened to every single thing that they had to talk about, right? And we've taken that and the spirit of it and had those listening sessions now around the country, whether it's myself or Leslie Mack or Ayanna Pressley or Travis Ackers or whomever, right? We're actually going around and listening to people and trying to learn, right? And I think that's what differentiates Elizabeth as well, is that she's learning, right? And I think the best educators do that. They learn constantly because it helps them teach better.
Is her professorial demeanor a hindrance or a help in on the presidential campaign trail?
Well, I don't see it like that. I think that her demeanor is that of someone who is well-informed, thoughtful. You know, frankly, I think that this can't be stated enough. The woman's brilliant. And I don't think that we should look at it in any other way. And I don't know that if it was a man, we would, right? She is one of the most, if not the most accomplished person that ran for president in this cycle. You know, she's the only one that without any political capital was able to return $12 billion to homeowners who big banks had
attacked. Let's talk about that, because Elizabeth Warren essentially created the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Let's talk about that aspect of her background for people that aren't familiar with it.
Yeah, absolutely. So Elizabeth Warren, prior to becoming a politician, which she's only been for 7 years, which I think is very special because she's not a career politician, she was a professor and one of the most highly regarded bankruptcy attorneys in the country. Prior to that, she was a special education teacher. And her focus while being a professor was, what is happening to the middle class in regards to the economic crisis and home ownership, right? And she found that, you know, there were predatory characteristics of banking. So she went down to DC and she, you know, said, we're going to make a change. She knocked on doors, called President Obama until he had no choice but to give her the opportunity to create this bureau that ended up returning $12 billion to people, especially black and brown people, people like people in Duval, people like people in South Florida and around Florida, when no one else was doing that for them. She has been the people's champion for most of her career.
Okay, let's go to a few more calls for Frederick Joseph. He's in town today as a surrogate for the Elizabeth Warren campaign. Joseph is famed as the creator of the Black Panther Challenge. It is the largest GoFundMe campaign to date in history and raised money to help tens of thousands of kids go see the Black Panther film in theaters. We're getting emails, calls, and tweets. Here's an email from a listener. I'm still undecided. I can't decide who'll get my vote. I may not know until I'm ready to mark the ballot at my polling place. My main objective is to put forth a candidate who will win the general election, which may mean I must put ideological purity aside. Let's go to Marcus on the north side. Hi, Marcus. Good morning. What are your thoughts about the election?
Hi. Good morning. I'm personally incredibly concerned about Bernie Sanders. I think he's a death note for not only the White House, but everybody else down ballot. I personally love Senator Warren. I think her positions are fantastic. I have one comment and one question. My comment was, a lot of women I know were incredibly turned off by her "kill it" comment to Bloomberg. It seemed like she was piling on. And that was hearsay, and she should know better than to quote hearsay. My question is, I want to do everything I can to make sure that we have an electable nominee. I'd like to vote for Elizabeth Warren. I think she's fabulous, but I'm afraid that would be a wasted vote and that I should get behind Biden, who I think has the best chance of not only getting nominated, but beating Trump and carrying the down ballot races. Convince me that my vote for Elizabeth in Florida wouldn't be wasted.
All right, Marcus, what's your message, Frederick, to that voter, Marcus, on the north side?
Well, I think, first of all, she'd be the best president since JFK, frankly, and the most progressive president since FDR. Her history is, and I'm going to just put this really frankly, it's in dismantling oppression. It's in dismantling people who have overstepped their bounds like Trump, right? So in terms of wasting a ballot, I think that a ballot will be wasted on anyone who's not Elizabeth Warren because she's the only one we've seen firsthand get the job done, right? If we need someone who actually has plans to not just get us back to the status quo, but reverse a ton of the things that Donald Trump has done and understands how to do that, Elizabeth Warren is the candidate, right? She is the person who was taking notes during the impeachment trial and not just worried about getting back to the campaign trail. She is the person who has developed the plan for coronavirus and infectious diseases before the president had them. She is the person who billionaires in this race decided to run against because they knew that she could beat them, right? So, and I also don't think that it's any it's no coincidence that Donald Trump has been attacking her for years now, right? These people understand who their biggest threats are, and their biggest threat, Donald Trump's biggest threat, is Elizabeth Warren.
Well, we appreciate you stopping by. Frederick Joseph, the creator of the Black Panther Challenge, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Joseph is a surrogate for the Warren campaign. We will continue our efforts to book surrogates for all the major campaigns in advance of Florida's March 17th primary election. And up next, how Ready for Work is expanding from Duval to St. Johns County, helping people leaving incarceration but rebuild their lives. We'll be right back. Thank you.
WJCT invites you to join us for an evening with Ari Shapiro on Thursday, April 2nd. Award-winning journalist and weekday co-host of All Things Considered, NPR's award-winning afternoon news program, will join WJCT's president and CEO, David McGowan, for an engaging conversation. Visit wjct.org/events for ticket information. Sponsored by the Community Foundation for Northeast Florida. Take a drive with us into the blues horizon. The best in classic and modern blues. every Monday and Wednesday night at 11. Right here on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Ready for Work St. Johns County is now open in the Lincolnville neighborhood of St. Augustine. Now, Ready for Work provides reentry services and job skills training to people reentering the community following incarceration. Great news for St. John's. Kevin Gay is founder of CEO of Operation New Hope and Ready for Work. He's here in studio, and also with us, the Reverend Ron Rawls of St. Paul's AME Church in Lincolnville. Hey, guys. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa.
Kevin, let's start with you. Ready for Work has been a fabulous player in Duval County for some time. Now you're in Lincolnville in St. Augustine. Tell me more about how this came about.
Well, Melissa, couldn't be more excited. Reverend Rawls and I were talking when we were waiting to come in that we started this journey about two and a half years ago in a little small conversation in a living room in St. Augustine that the community stakeholders in St. Augustine really wanted to get our work in St. Augustine, knowing that there were the same issues that were going on in St. Augustine that there are all around the country. Mm-hmm. And so what I didn't know was going on, I've always loved St. Augustine, but I didn't also know that the incredible work of a great group of community partners that were at the table that really wanted to get involved in this. And Reverend Rawls was at the very first meeting, has really been a great leader in this conversation. And so we couldn't be more excited about the opportunity in St. Augustine.
Reverend Rawls, how significant is this for Lincolnville and for St. John's County to have Ready for Work now operating there?
Well, in my line of work, we're called to the task of empowering people, specifically those who are dealing with the weight of life. This is done first through the sharing of resources that for whatever reason the person may not currently have access to, and secondly, the removal of unnecessary barriers and obstacles which prohibit equitable opportunities for progress. When I was invited to attend the meeting that Kevin referred to three or so years ago at the home of the Dunns in our Lincolnville neighborhood to hear a presentation from Mr. Gay about efforts to assist our returning citizens in the reentry process as it relates to obtaining gainful employment and earning living wages, I was eager to hear. But once I visited the site here in Jacksonville a couple months later, I was convinced that my brothers and sisters in St. John's County would greatly benefit from this program. But I always was very vocal that we needed to ensure that the spirit and culture that I sensed at the Jacksonville location had to be woven into the fabric of our effort in St. Augustine to truly have an opportunity to succeed. And I think we have paid attention to the details and are prepared to offer a transformational service in St. Augustine.
And when people come to Ready for Work in Lincolnville, what will the process be like? What will they be able to do?
Well, I think with our center there, we've hired all of the positions that are available. And the thing that I've noticed when I look at and when we've tried to replicate and duplicate what we've seen in Duval County, but those in our community that have within 3 years of being incarcerated from our correction system, that they're able to now come into a situation to where they're being empowered. Mm-hmm. And then so they'll go through training. They'll be put in a position to where they'll be prepared for employment and really offer something to that employer with the assistance that it needs to sustain the work. And the training that they'll go through.
And Kevin, as you've been talking about for years, the biggest obstacle for people leaving incarceration is gainful employment, finding right. a job. And if they can't find a good job, they may reoffend.
Absolutely. Well, as Reverend Rawls said, it's about getting them ready for that job because we know that's a game changer. And what I got excited about with St. Augustine was how the community got together. The city manager, John Regan, for example, said, we as a city will hire. And so they've agreed to ban the box and to knock those walls down.
And the box is checking whether you've had a felony conviction
right.
on an employment application?
The employment application asks, have you ever been arrested? Have you ever been charged? Have you ever been convicted? So really what it's asking is if you've had one of those, you're guilty because we're going to put your resume off the side. So
right.
just by showing by example that the city really wants this to work. We got a state attorney like we do with Melissa Nelson that's fully on board. We've got judiciary. I mean, there are city commissioners across the board. Yeah, we call it a city of, Melissa, a city of second chances. You can have the best reentry work and play, but if the city doesn't want these folks to be successful, meaning that they're not going to give them jobs, they're not going to provide housing and work together, and we have all of those ingredients at play in St. Augustine in a mm-hmm. big way.
And that's important, Reverend Rawls. That makes a difference, doesn't it?
Yes, ma'am. You know, I feel that the church is really designed to be the epicenter for second and even additional chances. It is the last place a person should come to and feel judged and unassisted for personal improvement. There's a story in the scriptures in my faith where Jesus encountered seven or so people who had been out all night fishing because they were hungry and had no success. They were actually cleaning their nets and ready to give up when they encountered Jesus, the literal embodiment and model of the work that the church has been called to do. And Jesus asked them about their efforts and gave them suggestions. They chose to follow the directions, and the result was a tremendous return on their investment. They caught so many fish that they could not haul them in to the shore from the boat. And one person actually had to literally jump in the water to assist in bringing the haul in the last 100 feet so the net wouldn't break. People simply need to be empowered and not condemned. And what better partner for this type of work than the church? This is what we were called to do, and we can do it in our own communities. We were built for this.
Now, with all of that said, let's talk about Day of Empathy. That's a national movement to raise awareness and empathy for the millions of Americans that have been impacted by the criminal justice system. There's a Day of Empathy Day coming up in St. Augustine. What's going to be happening?
We're excited. You know, last year, Melissa, we held it at UNF, and we had a phenomenal response, 250, 300 people across the board. And so we're going to do the same thing. And really what it is, Van Jones, you know, the CNN communicator, and has been a leading charge in this, Cut 50. And so they began the Day of Empathy 4 years ago. And we have been the representative for Florida. But what it is trying to get a community to understand how important empathy is in this conversation. And so, you know, we'll hear stories from the formerly incarcerated. The conversation that we're going to have this year is how a community is incarcerated. That it's not just an individual, but their family and the neighborhoods they come back to are all a part of this brokenness until we can fix. And so what I've learned personally, you know, and I was telling Reverend Rawls before we came in, you know, 25 years ago, I was the problem. Because I really assumed a lot about people, you know, from a distance. But as soon as that proximity shift collapsed and I got closer and closer, things changed. And we're hoping that that's what will happen in St. Augustine as well.
So you're inviting people to come on out to Flagler College, right, on March 25th. This is a free discussion. It's entitled How a Community is Incarcerated.
Yes, ma'am.
What is that? Can you explain what that means, how a community is incarcerated?
We were having this discussion. We have to understand that when a person is incarcerated, it's not just that person. It's everyone that person is connected to. And so a community has to be able to respond, digest, and handle, and still be able to progress once that happens. And I think that once that incarceration while it's going on, their children, their spouses, their family members, they're dealing with it. And then when that person returns, those people have to, they're there to provide support. And if there are things that we can do to assist in that transition and that reentry into our community, I think the overall the entire community is made stronger.
You can learn more at OperationNewHope.org. about the upcoming Day of Empathy and also their new St. Augustine Lincolnville location. And thank you both so much, Kevin Gay, founder and CEO of Operation New Hope and Ready for Work. Also with us, the Reverend Ron Rawls of St. Paul's AME Church in Lincolnville. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Melissa. And always great to be with you.
And congratulations. And we'll be right back.
Thank you.
Well, March is Women's History Month, and there's a new exhibit to spotlight. We're going to tell you about it right now. Jen Jones-Murray is here. She is the JAA Art and Culture Program Manager for the Jacksonville Aviation Authority. Also with us, Kimberly Miller, Founder and Executive Director of FemArt Gallery. Hey, good morning to you both.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Jen, let's start with you. This exhibit is called WAVE, Women Artists Visual Experiences.
Yes, we're very excited. We have 109 women artists from the Northeast Florida region on display at the airport. And with our research, we have discovered it is the largest single show of women artists in the history of art.
Get out of here.
I'm serious.
How'd you figure that out?
Well, Kim started researching. And actually, Kim, if you could explain, it's really exciting.
Yes, it's very exciting. I've been looking up women's history for the arts for quite a while, actually since 2017 when I started FemArt. Mm-hmm. And when I was looking it up, I was looking up the AIR group, which was the very first women's art gallery in our history. And FemArt is actually one of 13 organizations that dedicate to women artists, dedicate our focus to women artists. So,
and that's your mission. And so
yes.
This exhibit is displayed in the Haskell Gallery at the airport and throughout all art display areas throughout JAX Airport. So if you're coming into the airport to fly in or out, there's a gallery before you go through security.
Correct.
That's where people need to start.
Correct.
Right?
And actually, it begins at the very beginning. When you walk through the terminal, beginning at ticketing, you'll hit the connector bridge spaces. So there are women sculptors in those four quadrants. Then you enter the Haskell Gallery off the main courtyard. And then we have the spaces at Concourse A and C, all flanked with amazing women artists from our seven-county region.
And these are local artists. Can you tell us about some of them?
Yes, they are. We have some incredible women artists. FemArt actually started off 2020 with an art show that's separate, that we had 47 women artists, and we open up to all women artists. And thanks to Jen Jones-Murray, we have started opening up more art shows that don't have to be members of FemArt. So now we are more open to all the women in Jacksonville.
And you want women to join?
We want women to join our organization.
How can they do that?
They can go onto our website at femartgallery.org, and they can join us there and be part of this great women's movement that we are really bringing awareness of all of the great talents of women artists. And also, what's great about the airport show with 109 women artists is there's some debates of whether we should have an all-women's art show. And to give the big pro to that is we set a new canon for what the valuable art pieces really represent. And they represent 51% of our population, which is often hidden behind a lot of the male artists that are predominant in our society. So now we're seeing what women value and we're hearing their voices through the arts. So it's really important.
If you're just tuning in, we're speaking right now with Jen Jones-Murray of JAA and Kimberly Miller of FemArt Gallery about WAVE, a new exhibit at the Jacksonville International Airport in honor of this Women's History Month in March. Okay, and let me ask you, Jen, as well, how important is public art, whether it's a space like the airport or any public space?
Public art is extremely important. It is truly an extension of our humanity. It creates a space that explains and articulates our culture. And it is so embraced by the Jacksonville Aviation Authority. It's a true pleasure to be able to be a part of coordinating those efforts. We are one of 15 very recognized airports throughout the country for our public art program. And it creates a setting for travelers that is welcoming and provides a soothing distraction.
The Jacksonville International Airport tends to get high marks from travelers in general, and this is part of it, right? Just part of the overall experience of being, because if you're a frequent traveler, you've been to some nice airports and maybe some not so nice ones.
It's very true. We've actually been awarded for the last 5 years as one of the top five airports of our size nationally, and the art program is a part of that that experience.
Yeah, yeah. And so it is Women's History Month, and this is one way of honoring women's history and contributions now. It's my understanding, Kimberly, that you put out a call to artists from all over the region and the seven-county region that the airport services, and you just got a ton of submissions.
Yes,
right?
That is true. That is true. And what's really wonderful, too, is that we have women who just picked up a paintbrush or just started art about 9 months ago. And then we have some women who have had careers in art that have been in major galleries, and the wide range of art skills is really represented well here at the airport. So It's really nice to set out a call and have so many women answer that call. And it shows that women are in a different place today than what we've been in the past. Women are building more confidence, and they are becoming more aware that they are truly artists. I've had a couple of women who have joined FemArt who said they found it most difficult to call themselves an artist, even though their work was amazing and astonishing.
Why?
They find that in their minds, I think they are still falling under the canon of what our paternalistic society has said of what quality art is, and they're not sure if they fit into that standard. So this is allowing them to discover that they are truly valuable as artists, not just because they're following in the path of our historical male-dominant society, but because they're starting to recognize their voices are important.
And part of that is putting their art up for sale. Can people that see a piece in the airport buy the piece?
Absolutely, Melissa. In fact, we've already sold some pieces. So as the pieces have sold and they've gone out to a law firm in Atlanta, other wonderful locales around the country, we have the artist replace the piece, and so that we can continue the integrity of our 109 amazing women artists being featured.
So again, this exhibit is in the Haskell Gallery, which you'll see before you go through security, but it's in other spaces. Can you remind me again where people can see this exhibit throughout the month of March?
Absolutely. So we have rotating spaces that are rotated on a quarterly basis at the entrance to the airport, the Haskell Gallery, and also at the end of concourses A and C.
Okay. And of course, there's that fantastic public sculpture as you drive into the airport. I've mistakenly called it a couple of times on this program, the Goddess of the Wind, but that's not what it's called. it's a woman's head. And that's some more art celebrating women at the airport.
Absolutely.
What is the name of it again?
It's Oy S. Hoy.
That's it. Thank
yes,
you.
Absolutely.
I knew you would know. And so, Jen Jones-Murray, thank you so much. She is the JAA Art and Culture Program Manager for the Jacksonville Aviation Authority. Kimberly Miller is the founder and executive director of the FemArt Gallery. Again, their new exhibit, Wave, Women Artists Visual Experiences, is displayed throughout JIA to honor the contributions of women artists and Women's History Month, which is this month. So, ladies, thank you so much and congratulations.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Up next, Cole Pepper is a local coaching legend, steps down. Plus, he's got to look ahead to Players Week. We'll be right back.
Farrah and Farrah, dedicated to representing the injured people in Jacksonville for over 40 years. Learn more at farrahandfarrah.com or 396-5555. Farrah and Farrah's accident attorneys are here for you, here for good. The First Coast Relocation Guide, an annual publication dedicated to helping thousands of newcomers to Jacksonville make informed decisions. From realtors to restaurants, builders to boutiques, introduce your brand to potential customers. Info at heritagepublishinginc.com.
The song Lift Every Voice and Sing was written in Jacksonville. I'm Ben Brotmarkle, and coming up on Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, we'll hear about the song known as the Negro National Anthem for more than a century. We'll discuss unique Florida tree snail shells and Afrofuturism at the Zora Neale Hurston Festival. That's Florida Frontiers, Monday evening at 6:30 on 89.9 WJCT.
4.5 million Americans are on probation or parole, and that's more than twice the nation's jail population. On the next Fresh Air, Jason Hardy talks about his 4 years as a parole officer in New Orleans, where he struggled to help the 200 people in his caseload. Sometimes he found a trip back to jail was the compassionate choice. His book is The Second Chance Club. Join us.
Today at noon on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
The U.S. and Taliban have agreed on a peace deal, one that promises to write the final chapter in America's longest war. An agreement that brings both hope and fear, but it does put an end in sight. But the peace accord is more of a beginning. So what happens now? Afghanistan and the way out, next time on 1A.
Today at 10 on 89.9 WJCT. Culpepper Sports Wrap-Up is brought to you by Farrah and Farrah.
Welcome back. Well, one of the most successful high school football coaches in the region is stepping down. Culpepper's here now with a little bit more about that. I'll just sing your theme song.
There we go. Yeah.
Oh, there it is. How are you doing, Cole?
I'm doing well. And Duran Wiley stepping down from his position at Reigns. The two-time state championship winning coach is taking time to spend with family. In 11 seasons at his alma mater, Wiley led the Vikings to a 99-33 record, won two state championships in 2017 and 2018. Also took the Vikings to the state finals in 2015. It's going to be interesting to see how they fill that position. The history and the tradition and the success at Reigns means the candidates are going to have to live up to some major expectations.
Sure.
In the midst of that announcement, we have to reflect on the passing of Corky Rogers, the great Bulls, and before that, Lee head coach. By the way, Duran Wiley regularly said that he was made a better coach by his rivalry with Rogers. They were in the same district for several years. I called all those games on radio when I was doing the Bulls games. Rogers passed away on Wednesday at the age of 76.
And wasn't he beloved? My goodness.
And you could talk about his numbers and talk about what he did in terms of wins, and we shouldn't overlook those numbers. Six different Halls of Fame he's been enshrined in. Nine of his players were drafted in the NFL, including Leroy Butler, who was a Hall of Fame finalist this past year. 10 state titles, 465 wins are both records in the state of Florida. But his big impact really is more about the lasting mark he left on the young men that he coached. I learned a lot about Corky Rogers in those 4 years of calling those games, being around him. He taught thousands of young men how to be better than they thought they could be. Mm. His legacy is going to be more than just winning football games, but the difference he made in the lives of his players and the lessons those players have passed on to their children and grandchildren. I've heard from a lot of his former players here in the last several days. For me, he's on the Mount Rushmore of Jacksonville sports.
Right.
Artis Gilmore, Corky Rogers, and we can argue about the other two who are on there, but those two are certainly on my Mount Rushmore, Jacksonville sports.
On the Pepper list. Okay. Let's go a week ahead in the calendar because, of course, people are already making their plans on how they're going to enjoy the Players' Championship.
Yep. A week from today, some of the best golfers in the world will begin to descend on TPC Sawgrass in advance of the Players. There are some changes you should know about if you're heading out to the course. All the tickets this year are going to be mobile tickets, so you'll have to have them on your phone. You must have a ticket for every day. There are no more season or week-long passes and so forth. Also, you have to have a ticket for parking every day to find a parking pass. You can go online at theplayers.com. The Players is always a great way to spend time with the kids as well. 18 and under are free with a ticketed adult. And, of course, Rory McIlroy will be back to defend his title. Melissa, no golfer in the history of the event has won back-to-back Players' Championships.
Think he can do it?
He not only thinks he can do it, he says he wants to make some history doing so, and certainly Rory is going to be one of the handful of players who are going to be the favorites heading into the tournament.
And some new stuff this year, the Chainsmokers are performing.
Yep, that's part of the Military Appreciation Day on Tuesday. It's the first time I think they've had a top 40 group coming to play. They continue to just tweak the event and make it a little bit better and better each and every year. It's one of my favorite weeks of the year. And it comes on the heels of one of my favorite days of the year to cover, which is the Gate River Run, which is Saturday when we'll crown the national champion in the 15K here in Jacksonville. Some 20,000 runners will take part in the various races, and we will broadcast the race live on Channel 4 once again as we did last year. We're also putting a focus on local runners. The fastest man and woman at the gate win the First Coast Cup. Last year, Chris McCaffrey and Julie Stackhouse won the cups a year ago, and we'll be seeing if they can repeat this year. I would say Chris is probably the favorite on the men's side, and Julie is one of the favorites on the women's side heading in.
All right. Now, you just did a little running yourself, you told me, before we came out of the break.
You know, Saturday was the Ortega River Run. Usually there's a two-week gap in between to see what happens there, but I did a little running and a little walking in the 5-mile race. Interesting, though,
but you
because
finished.
I did finish. And the field a little thinner this year because a lot of folks were up in Atlanta for the Olympic marathon trials. Mm. Three runners from Jacksonville, in fact, participated in the Olympic marathon trials. Enoch Nadler from Gainesville on the men's side, and on the women's side, Morgan Hull. And also Kelsey Beckman, who will be on our broadcast for the Gate River Run, ran in the Olympic marathon trials in Atlanta.
Kudos to them.
One more thing we need to get to, which is some semi-breaking Jaguars news this morning,
yes.
Melissa.
Yes, we just heard about this.
Yeah, this morning, Yannick Ngakoue, who wakes up earlier than I do, tweeted out that he was done with playing in Jacksonville. He let the Jaguars know he wasn't going to sign a long-term contract and basically said, thanks, Duval, I'm out. It is not a definitive change in what's going to happen. Sort of expected that he didn't want to sign a long-term deal here. He's not pleased with the direction of the organization. The Jaguars do have some recourse. They can tag him as the franchise player on the team. Then Ngakoue would have to sign that if he wants to play this year. If he did, he would play for 1 year for the average of the top five salaries of defensive ends from this past season. That's about $19.3 million for 1 year. Ngakoue wants to be the highest paid defensive end of the National Football League, which would be about a $22 million a year deal. Of course, the Jaguars probably should have signed him to a long-term deal before last year. That didn't get done. I suspect we're going to see Ngakoue not sign the deal and hold out as long as he can to try to force a sign-and-trade situation where he would agree to a contract or agree to the terms with another team. After what happened last year in the offseason with Telvin Smith and then during the season with Jalen Ramsey, here is another player who is a big high-dollar, impactful player who the Jaguars are probably not going to be able to keep on the field this
year. That's too bad to hear. Well, always get your sports from Cole Monday on this show and every night on Channel 4 and on Twitter at Cole Pepper. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Melissa.
That is our show. I'm Melissa Ross. We will replay this broadcast tonight at 8 o'clock if you missed anything today and connect with you again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great Monday.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.